This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Information at 503-595-9550. They're on Facebook or at grendelscoffee.com. This KBOO program has also been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Clinton Street Theater, featuring independent and revival films, the Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com. And now for Paul Rowland and Wednesday Morning Talk Radio.
You come here and gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath a vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few.
And good morning. This is Talk Radio. I'm your guest host, Paul Rowland, filling in for Lisa Loving this morning. And you all might remember that's Makana. He made a splash at a certain time during the rising of the Occupy movement when he played that song at a banquet where Barack Obama was present. I thought it was pretty gutsy. Like that song too. So good morning, Justin.
Good morning, Paul.
And Tim.
Hey, how's it going?
That's Justin Kay and Tim Hitchens, and they're here to talk about the resistance ecology. They were on a little bit more briefly last week on Thursday with Linda's show. I can't remember, she has a hyphenated last name. I can't remember her last name. Anyway, there you go. Olson Osterlund. And they're got a little more time this morning, and we're going to take call-ins to talk about resistance ecology, this conference, and this new movement that's arising out of Portland, Oregon. And so maybe we can get started, and you could talk a little bit about how you got involved in the wonderful world of activism and some of the groups you've been involved with.
Sure. Maybe this is Tim, by the way. Maybe I can get that started, and then Justin can kind of take over. So I'm in my mid-30s now. I actually have been an animal rights activist, environmental activist, since I was about 20 years old. And I kind of got involved the way a lot of people got involved. I was kind of grew up in South Florida, always kind of knew that the standard version of life that we were being told to follow was not correct and not complete. And at one point in college, I was introduced to Kevin Jonas of Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty. I was involved in a local organizing group called the Environment Action Group, and we were working in coordination with the animal rights group on campus, and we invited him to come, and I was not really radicalized at that time. But anyway, I had an opportunity to listen to Kevin speak, and for those of you that don't know who Kevin was, he was actually just recently released from prison, spent six years in jail for the Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty campaign, for being involved in a campaign that essentially shut down one of the world's most notorious product testing laboratories multiple times, but got bailed out by the British government and many banks. But anyway, I saw him speak and realized that it was very important for me to take action, and that's something that I have kept in spirit for pretty much the rest of my life. And it's been years and years later, and here we are with Resistance Ecology. Many different versions of different grassroots groups, but here we are with Resistance Ecology, and hoping to get a new component of the movement started, learning from our mistakes from the past, and move forward.
And of course, in Florida, you know, can't help but see the incredibly rapid expansion of corporatization and development.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. In particular, recently I flew home and it was a night flight, and as I was coming in, I could see for miles and miles, as far as the eye could see, just the line of lights juxtaposed with the darkness of the Everglades. And it was extremely sad to think that 95% of all wading birds, natural species that once existed and flourished in the Everglades are now close to dying, close to extinction, or already gone. So.
And Justin, how about you?
Well, I'm from the Northwest. I got involved when I was about 18, or I started in high school, but I don't really count that all that much. But I got involved right out of high school, getting involved in a student group that I still have on campus, Portland State University's campus, which is Student Animal Liberation Coalition. I also got involved in the Portland Animal Defense League when I moved here. And I kind of think what characterizes my early involvement and kind of what shaped my, still what I have as current views, are the movement was, I'm only 24, so I have a pretty young perspective here, but the movement has been so stagnant in the last few years, if not a little bit longer. I'm talking about the animal rights and environmental movement primarily. And I had such an idealized version of what it was going to be when I started to get involved that I started to wonder what are the sorts of circumstances that brought it to where it is now, and what are the kind of things that we need to do as kind of the whatever is left of the lifeblood of the movement in order to try to change it and get it to adapt for the changing circumstances of the future. And a lot of things have changed in the last few decades, and these movements have grown, and they're both so young, with perspective that a lot of social movements have gained and that these two have not gained as much. Since they're kind of fledgling as it is, and what are the types of things that we need to do as activists in these movements in order to kind of build the type of world that we want to see that's not just reinventing the wheel, that's not ahistorical, that doesn't just isolate itself to single issue politics. And that's kind of the short story of how I got involved.
And we're talking about Resistance Ecology, and the conference is coming up this weekend. And, of course, we'd like to talk a fair amount about who's going to be there, what some of the panels are, the speakers. It's going to start on Friday. Is that right?
Friday evening is just kind of an opening night with the first introductory thing from us, and then a little panel by people from the George Jackson Brigade. And then most of the conference really starts on Saturday.
And so where is it going to be at PSU?
It will be in Portland State University's Smith Memorial Student Union. That's on its address 1825 Southwest Broadway downtown, and it will be in room 236,
second floor
of the Smith Building. You'll see it. We'll have signs up and everything.
Do you think they'll be big enough? How many? Do you have any idea how many?
It has a. I don't know for sure. It has a capacity of 70 officially. But, I mean, we'll see how things go the opening night and how many people want to show up from that time period. And then for the rest of the conference, we'll have a lot more space available, obviously.
Lots of different panels going on at the same time.
But everything's going to be on the second floor of the building, so people don't get lost. It's easy to get lost at PSU.
Okay, well, we can talk about that as we go along, like what some of the panels mm-hmm. are, where some of the people are coming from. But I was really – I was impressed. I read finally yesterday, this on the website, which is conference.resistanceecology.org, you can go there and find out, you know, look at the program. But it took me a while to find a really lengthy history. It actually prints out as 4 pages, the vision and goals, which kind of lays out, you know, starts a little bit what we were talking about, like sort of what your thoughts were, what the need for some new kind of movement or sort of change in direction or sort of more comprehensive approach, whatever it is that you're thinking, and like what some of the different threads going into that, like some of the background of your own, the people who are organizing this and like their connections, how you got involved, you know, trying to bring back one thing that I thought was really interesting as someone who was very involved about 15 to 20 years ago in Portland, in Oregon, with Earth First and a lot of other stuff, is this whole history since personally I've been gone and post 9/11, post Green Scare, there's this history that I'm just getting familiar with that has really sort of changed the landscape of activism, and especially with Green Scare of environmental activism. And I just like to tell a little story as I got involved. Briefly, I was in Eugene last year in the summer, and I was hanging out with the Cascadia Forest Defenders, went on a camp out and went to the Cascadia Earth First rendezvous out on the coast, and talking to these people about this history and like their take on things. And this one young woman said, yeah, you know, growing up as a really young person, you know, kind of precociously interested in the world around her and growing up in Eugene. And so like, you know, all this stuff had been happening, all this really intense stuff had been happening, and kind of like really interested, and then coming of age and like finally like able to, you know, having the autonomy and the freedom to like make choices and get involved in things, and like looked around and there was nothing going on. And it was like a real shock. And that must be a real shock. I mean, to me, coming to Portland is kind of like, as Earth First was just becoming this really major presence, and just like from, you know, a dozen people to hundreds of people to thousands of people in chapters everywhere, it was like a really amazing time. Just these contrasts within, I mean, a short period of time, within the lifetime of an half a lifetime of an individual.
Absolutely.
And that's exactly kind of where I was coming from. I mean, to be, I guess, analogous to her situation. And it is, it's just very, it's somewhat disheartening to be young and led to believe by the people that you first contact that there's this rich movement you're going to get involved in, and then find out that there's not a lot going on, or that you can't rely on a lot of people to get things done, and that there's discontinuity, and there's a lot of, I can't speak ill of like a lot of the things that I got. I mean, the people that got me involved, and I have nothing but admiration. But at the same time, we have to be aware that we have to be honest with ourselves as a movement and where we're coming from now, and not just kind of pretend that things are not, that there aren't some problems that need to be addressed. I mean, it's okay to admit that these movements were major targets of federal and corporate harassment, and that it had long-lasting ripple effects in the movement that are still being felt. It's okay to admit that the movements have historically isolated themselves through politics that are quite singular and ahistorical sometimes, and it's okay to say that we can grow. And those discussions are, it's like, sometimes I think they're taboo. And right from the beginning of my involvement, it seemed like that was kind of the norm. And I can't say that that's true on a national scale at all. It's just the little window that I had. But it is kind of disheartening to be young, 18, fervent, and then you get involved and find out that energy is going nowhere.
Yeah, I mean, just to add to that, I think, you know, kind of what we're discussing right now is indicative of activism in general. And even at the heights of you know, the animal liberation movement in particular, you know, in the late 90s and early 2000s onto the mid 2000s, before a huge wave of repression came down, you know, it's, you know, maybe to your listeners or to anybody, you know, really important thing to hit home is that you can sit there and you can feel, you know, really badly about, you know, animal suffering or environmental degradation or anything within social justice. And, you know, just sitting there and thinking about it is not necessarily enough. You have to actually then take those thoughts and engage in some form. And, you know, and that's ultimately what it comes back to, is that, you know, we we have to activate eventually. And even during the heights of that, there still wasn't the animal liberation movement, the grassroots radical animal liberation movement was still very small. It was just a very small amount of people that were able to inflict a great deal of damage to in during the mid-2000s, particularly the vivisection or animal testing industry.
Yeah, but there's obviously a spectrum of stuff, and however much one wants to criticize and, you know, are rightly criticizable, some of the quote, larger institutional mainstream groups who also like tend to distance themselves from the, you know, more direct action or radical groups. But, you know, there are quite a number of both sympathizers and people actively donate and people who are, you know, actively involved in different levels of organization of these groups. And it's so I think it is, but it's still a very small percentage regardless. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you know, you're talking about what I think you're talking about is like a small percentage within a fairly small milieu, but substantial. I mean, the number of people who sympathize with these issues is fairly large.
And me saying that is definitely not to discredit at all. I mean, if anyone is doing anything, even if that's, you know, writing a letter or donating, or those things are crucial to the broader movement, and each component of that is, you know, a very important part of the ultimate goals involved. It's just, you know, the amount of people that, you know, it all depends on how much time you're actually spending, you know, making a donation or whatever is, you know, that's something quick you can do during your day, but the amount of people that are dedicating themselves or have the time or the resources to dedicate themselves fully is always been a small component. But
I mean, that's these questions are kind of part of this whole discussion as well that we're trying to have at this conference and with this group in general. Is, I mean, this is a major component of this discussion, is that we have limited resources, as any social movement does, and what are the ways that we can spend them, each individually and as groups and as organizations or what have you, and have kind of the biggest impact. Figure out where the weak points in our opposition are that also have the biggest effects. You know, what are the linchpins of these industries that we oppose? You know, where is the nexus of the kind of the beast, the system that we all oppose? And also, when we discuss limited resources in particular sense with the animal rights or environmental movement and how small they are, we also have to ask questions about why are they so small? Why can't we have a little bit larger base to draw resources from or to draw involvement from? Why do we have to have such very small, isolated movements? And I mean, in comparison to a lot of other issues that people do care about, environmentalism obviously is something that's broad, but when it comes to doing action or direct action for the environment, it's a very small group. It's a very small group doing animal rights stuff on a national scale. Why is it so small? Does it have to be that way, or are there things that we can do as activists to try to grow the movement in various ways?
And to be okay with if when we ask those questions, we have, you know, we find difficult answers or more difficult questions to pose ourselves, to be okay with that and to, you know, utilize that as something to strengthen ourselves so that we can see what our own weaknesses are, not only currently, but also historically, and grow and strengthen from that.
Well, I would like to say that the phone number here is 503-231-8187. In a few minutes, we'll be taking some phone calls. Wanted to talk a little bit more specifically about the conference. We make sure we do that before we get into a lot of conversations with the listeners, with the callers. My name's Paul Rowland. This is the Wednesday morning talk show. I'm guest hosting for Lisa Loving. And my guests are Justin Kay and Tim Hitchens, who are two of the organizers of the Resistance Ecology Conference, which is coming up this weekend here in Portland at Portland State University. So, yeah, how about what are some of the panels that people can go to and some of the speakers coming in?
Well, for a full list, I encourage anyone to go to the website, conference.resistanceecology.org. But a couple highlights that I'm personally looking forward to, something that's been in the works for a while, is we're trying to have a panel discussing the long-term and short-term relationship between radical environmentalism and animal rights over the last few decades, and kind of what have been the ebb and flows in that relationship. Why do those movements seem to be not working together all the time when they have so many commonalities? And has it always been that way? We're bringing people that have had Earth First history for decades, Karen Coulter, Chris Maines, who have been Earth Firsters in the Northwest for decades each, Josh Harper and Jake Conroy are both members of the Shack 7, Jeff Lewis, who went to prison for an ELF action in the late 90s. He was in prison for 10 years.
For actually burning, I think it was like two or three tires of some SUVs.
Yeah, it was the action that took place in Eugene.
And, you know, he has a perspective of someone who's been kind of straddling both movements. But we're trying to have like a dialogue there about those issues. And then having, let's see, we have a good panel from Patrice Jones, who is an activist from the East Coast who runs an animal sanctuary out there. But she's also a longtime activist involved in the Shack campaign. And she's also a therapist and addressing trauma as social movements. And what are our shortcomings there? How can we be better dealing with the fact that we do expose ourselves to trauma repeatedly when we oppose the state or corporate interests? So we have a whole slew of things, but I'm sure Tim could think
of that's like a too. Highlight. And just to kind of broaden further what Justin's saying here, you know, when organizing this conference, one of the, you know, main goals that we wanted to enact in doing this was, you know, to make sure that we were striking the importance of inter-movement building as well as intergenerational movement mm-hmm. building, understanding our history. One of the organizers who's not here was on the show last week, Josh Harper, one of the former Shack 7, has, since he's been released from prison, he's running a website called The Talent Conspiracy, which is essentially an archive of every radical zine and magazine that ever came out for the animal liberation movement, so that all the way back to the 80s and now as early as the 70s, so that, you know, these really hard to find zines that you know were taken in raids or, you know, put up, you know, and stopped being printed years ago, he's been able to find. And not only that, but the intersectionality of our movements as well. We're having, you know, people that are going to be local members of the community, people from the Portland Central America Solidarity Committee, people from Rising Tide. I'm forgetting some other people from Super. We're going to be doing it. There's going to be a panel on Israeli apartheid and ecological devastation.
We have Breeze Harper and Lauren Onelis coming from out of town. They're both women of color who are involved in animal rights work and also, I mean, primarily work dealing with intersectionality. Breeze Harper is just got her doctorate from UC Davis doing critical geography studies, wrote her dissertation on the way veganism essentially can either create or recreate or deconstruct the conceptions of whiteness, depending on how we go about addressing those politics. With Lauren Onelis as a food justice activist with the Food Empowerment Project, she's not only going to be discussing the politics of food justice more broadly, but also how can we as animal rights activists, if, you know, that's our target audience at the moment, how do we address the shortcomings of veganism as just simply our solution to everything in the world, and how it's not realistic and it's also quite privileged, and how do we address those from an intersectional perspective and also from a practical perspective if we want to grow the movement? And her and Breeze Harper will actually both be speaking on the topic of intersectionality.
And it's intersectionality meaning the intersection of different movements,
yeah. Also different identities. And what I mean, the original term kind of derives from Angela Davis's use of it, describing how one is, in her experience, that one is both black and a woman, not just one or the other. And we as we don't want to be guilty of appropriating a term that comes from women of color like that, but it is something that can be applied to really any movement, and how it can either address the intersections of its work and the institutions that it opposes, or it can't. And if it chooses not to, and it's a choice, if it chooses not to, is it going to be successful in the long run if it thinks it's just working in isolation from everything else?
Well, we do have a call. I would like to talk a little bit more about this, what you're talking about now, as we go along, if we have time. But we have Heidi on the line. Go ahead, Heidi.
Oh, hey, guys. I'm actually from Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights.
Yeah, awesome.
Hey, I'm looking forward to meeting you guys. I'm calling in because I'm trying to put all these ideas together for the, you know, ecology resistance of ecology with in context of the Palestinian Liberation Movement. And so the panel that we're going to be doing, you guys have titled it Apartheid in Ecological Devastation. One of the things I want, what intersects for me on a level from personal standpoint is my daughter and I are also involved in the animal rights movement. So we identify as vegan. And so one of the really exciting things about the intersectionality of Palestinian liberation as well as that is anarchists against the wall in Israel. So Israelis standing in solidarity with Palestinians who self-identify as vegan, bringing those values into the movement, and then they do a really great job of articulating why that's important. And so I just wanted to thank you guys publicly for, you know, bringing us into the dialogue, and also I appreciate the fact that you're trying to do inter-movement building, and I think it's a really exciting time for that. I just wanted to give a shout-out for Scott Crow, though. Folks don't know who he is. He's fabulous and awesome, so if you just go to hear Scott Crow, that's perfect. But just real quick, so what we're going to be talking about specifically from the apartheid perspective and what the devastation of the occupation looks like, not only for the people but for the land, and trying to debunk a lot of those myths surrounding what the occupation is, how the media portrays it, and trying to bring in also the Palestinian voice, which I think is not always brought in. And so I just wanted to let folks know that we're trying to create a really dynamic talk for folks to come and learn maybe the first time about what the occupation is and also how that intersects with other movements and why it's important to hear about the issues. So that's kind of my plug for our panel on Sunday at 4. But thanks for all the work that you guys are doing, and I look forward to meeting you on Sunday.
Thank you so much. To meeting you, too.
Yeah, this is an issue that we're super stoked to have part of the panel. It's something that both Justin and I feel very strongly about, too. So
thank you so much. I really appreciate
it.
You guys have a great day. Okay,
right. Bye. Thanks for calling, Heidi. Yeah, that was it really is heartbreaking just to see the bulldozing of these, you know, hundreds of years old olive trees. That in itself, I mean, obviously, you know, the killing and harassment and repression of people. But I mean, just, you know, the way people have been attached, you know, have had a living culture for so long, you know, based upon, you know, the olive and some other things that are the things that are able to grow there, for crying out loud. It's not easy. Mm-hmm. They develop that, and then they just, like, put a wall, and, you know, you live on one side, and your orchard is on the other side, stuff like that. It's pretty insane. So I think we do have one more caller. Sean, you're on the line. Go ahead.
Hey, guys. I was calling to see if you guys have ever had an experience similar to this. You go to, like, a family reunion or a family get-together of some kind, and, like, this question goes to, like, what the society holds in high esteem. And, you know, you'll have, like, cousins or relatives of some form or another, and, like, they'll be studying finance or majoring in business or, you know, starting a business of their own or something. And there'll be all this, like, admiration and respect for those people. And then it comes around to, like, oh, well, this guy, he's, like, he's getting into activism, you know. And there's, like, this silence, you know. Have you guys ever had an experience like that? And, you know, doesn't that really go to the core of what's wrong with America? What we hold in esteem, what we respect? And if you guys have any comments on that, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Sure. Right, thanks for calling, Sean.
Thanks so much. Yeah, that's actually a good question. It seems like pretty much for me, when I first went vegan, this is definitely something that came up. My sister happens to be somebody that we'll just say falls along with the mainstream a little bit. So we would, you know, decided to have a big family and buy a house, have a dog, all of that. And, you know, when we would go home and have, you know, our family dinner or whatever, you know, there would be some vegan food on the table, and that would automatically, you know, lead to why are you having this extreme life? And I think it was important to show that, you know, we as activists tend, or, you know, we as people that decide to not follow the status quo are, this is my own personal feelings, that, you know, we try hard to read books and educate ourselves. And this isn't, you know, this is something that we've been privileged to be able to do, so that when we're in a situation where others have not necessarily had that opportunity, we need to remember that how we talk to them, we need to still be respectful and, you know the key points of when someone's going to ask about where you get your protein, where do you, you know, like all of these key points to kind of be sure to answer those as politely as possible, not get mad, and try and make this lifestyle that we're trying, that we're, you know, portraying or trying to promote, not seem as something crazy, so that, you know, we can, you know, activate these people within our family. And actually, mm-hmm. you know, 13 years later at this point, all of the, for my house at least, all of the holiday meals, including for the children, are always vegan. So I feel pretty fortunate.
And I think that Sean's comments kind of highlight, I mean, he addresses like what is wrong with American society in this respect. And it kind of highlights an issue even within movements about the way that activism, quote unquote, or being an activist is perceived as some job or a status that you have that is analogous to someone doing, you know, studying finance, as he says. But why is it that we have to view it as if it is a job, or is it like an identifier that you have, like that person's an activist, like the rest of us are not activists? And it's something that everyone in America should be able to attach themselves to, is simply just engaging in society in one form or another, engaging in the institutions that control their lives, whether or not they see it that way. But being an activist, it'd be nice to see that kind of terminology done away with and just people that are just engaged. You don't have to be a political activist, quote unquote, to be struggling every day and opposing the institutions that oppressed you. You can just be trying to live your life and go to your job and still, in that sense, be struggling in a very real way. And I personally don't like seeing the term activism used as if it is a job, as an identifier. But that's partially our making, and it's definitely partially something that we get labeled as a way to discredit.
Well, I'd like to break in here for a second to say what's coming up on KBOO. And again, my name's Paul Rowland, and you were just listening to Justin Kay, and before that, Tim Hitchens, to the organizers of the Resistance Ecology Conference coming up this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, at Portland State University. So this morning at 9 on Political Perspectives here on KBOO Community Radio, you'll hear Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, talking about his recent article, Our Twisted Politics of Grief in the Endless War. Some kinds of grief are more useful than others. At 9:30 from the series Economic Update, host Richard Wolf interviews independent journalist and writer Laura Flanders of Grit TV. At 10, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. And at 10:15 on Flashpoints, there'll be a report on Israel's role in arming the Guatemalan military of the 1980s, and the weekly report on Occupy Palestine with Nora Barrows-Friedman and the electronic intifada.net. And at 11 on the Radio Zine, host Bruce Silverman interviews Portland's noise control officer Paul Van Orden, his predecessor Paul Herman, and Noise Review Board Chair David Sweet talk about noise control in Portland. And thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And yeah, I'd like to pick up on what you're saying, Justin. I has had the good fortune to be able to live in a place where my father's from in northern Italy. He immigrated to the United States in the mountains of northwestern Italy, where the history of the resistance is still alive. Actually, you know, the last people, just like the last World War II vets, are dying off. And there's only a few of them left, but the resistance was very strong there. And, you know, that was, you know, either you caved in to the Nazis at that time, or you resisted. And, you know, so they had a network of safe houses, network of support, people feeding them. And, you know, so the resistance was like broadly based, but there were specific individuals who, for whatever reasons, you know, had it in them to stand up much more directly and in an armed way in that case. And, you know, because you had the Nazis were actually occupying at that time. You know, we can talk about fascism, you know, creeping fascism, which does seem to be on the increase in the United States. Certainly, I don't know, since Reagan and then Bush, the two Bushes and Obama. We could talk endlessly about that, and I think there do need to be a lot of conversations about that. But anyway, it really put in stark contrast for me this idea of like standing up to there. It was just like, you know, sure, you could decide not to, and but then you would, you know, then after the war, everybody looked at you really badly. You know, it's like you were like a Nazi sympathizer. Mm-hmm. That's not good. Anyway, so we do have another caller. Joanne, go ahead, Joanne.
I just want to put out something. I live in public housing, and I put something in my mail rent payment last month that I wanted the spying and not the stop in this building. And I said, this is fascism. But anyway, yeah, all the repressions and oppressions that have been happening in this country at least since the 1990s, and especially my public housing day after day, how do you folks expect to have a real effect on this country, even with technology? I mean, I'm not being negative. I'm being real. And I'm going to hang up. Goodbye.
Okay. Well, thanks, Joanne. No, I mean, sure. It's a very real question. I mean, there's like, there's a lot of people in this country, and we're really, you know, generally just a relatively few people, you know, and of course, it's kind of I always think it's almost feels like kind of an elitist assumption. That's like, I know something more than other people, or like, mm-hmm. I know something that, so that I'm doing something that other people, these are like kind of difficult questions. And it is a real question. What are we, you know, we're not really, Jeffrey St. Clair had an article on Counterpunch about like the demise of the left. And it's true. There really isn't a serious oppositional movement going on. Mm-hmm. And like, who are we to think that we're going to jumpstart something? But heck, you know, if not us, who? If not now, where?
Exactly. You know, and this is actually a really good point that your caller brought up. And dealing with repression, this is a very real thing that the animal liberation and radical environmental movements in particular have recently dealt with. And this is something that resistance ecology wants to tackle and understand. And, you know, for us, you know, this comes again to these movements. How do we build a movement that can deal with this? And, you know, for us, you know, we'd like to think that the answer is that we do broaden our scope so that, you know, in the case of the Shack 7, for example, it was a very, you know, probably in the height, you know, about a few thousand activists were campaigning to take down, you know, a multinational corporation.
Well, and so you better say what Shack means, actually.
So Shack, Stop Hunting, I apologize. Shack, Stop Hunting Animal Cruelty was a campaign that started originally in England in 1999 on the backs of some very successful anti-vivisection or against animal testing campaigns. And eventually, basically the way that the campaign worked is that it went straight. It basically saw that every company or corporation is not just its logo, but also its board of directors, its CEOs, and every company that keeps it afloat, its bank, its, you know, its anyone that supplies it, et cetera. And it went after each and every component of Huntington Life Sciences, which was a multinational corporation, which killed about 500 animals every day to test things like Splenda coffee sweetener, weed killers, pesticides, you name it. They test it for anyone as a contract research organization. And they eventually, or what they were able to do was basically fight on the notion that every company that does business with Huntington Life Sciences doesn't necessarily need Huntington Life Sciences. Huntington Life Sciences needs them. And they would use very aggressive above ground and underground and support underground actions such as home protests or black faxes, and then, you know, in coordination with underground animal liberations, et cetera, and were basically able to get every single company that was doing business with Huntington Life Sciences to drop them. And it basically brought Huntington Life Sciences to its knees with a very small amount of people doing this. And unfortunately, the UK government in the end bailed them out. And in both the UK and the United States, a huge wave of repression came. And that comes back to what your caller was talking, is that the wave of repression came, because there was only a few thousand activists really working strongly on the issue, when everyone started being indicted and started, you know, like looking at some serious jail terms, for just being above ground organizers being charged with conspiracy, not actually being charged with any actions. There wasn't a lot of shouting from the broader social justice movement, because the single issue politics of the animal liberation movement had not broadened itself to make very strong connections and ties with, you know, all of these other movements. And this is, and so when people were looking at some serious jail times, there wasn't enough people standing up to them. The information wasn't getting, except for maybe Democracy Now! And other community radio sources, there wasn't a lot of information coming out. And, you know, these people just ended up getting portrayed as extremists and terrorists, which they were not. So, you know, again, this comes back to, like, we don't want to make the same mistake when repression comes. We want to make sure that there is a upswelling of support when people do take direct actions or do actions that are a little bit more, more direct, and so there'll be support for them.
Well, I think that, you know, I've been sort of talking informally about a lot, because it had such a major impact. You know, the whole Green Scare refers to the investigation and eventual incarceration of most, if not all, of the people who had been directly involved in the Earth Liberation Front. I'm sure there's more people who may have been involved or tangentially involved who thankfully may have escaped the net, but it seems like an awful lot of them got put in prison or ended up snitching. And but even most of them who snitched ended up getting time, which is something to think about as well. But in any case, it had a major impact on activism. You know, that and other things. And, you know, I guess I'll just go on record. I personally thought it was, like, not the most advisable thing to do at that particular moment. I thought Earth First at the time was really, you know, for all its faults that could be gone into, which we don't have time at this point, but really had developed a really pretty widespread movement. There's really a lot of people paying much more attention to issues that nobody had any idea of just a few years before. And a lot of young people coming out of college, you know, you could say privileged people, but people who might have been going on a professional career track otherwise, you know, they got into activism and their lives were changed as a result of it. I know. I mean, I was one of them, although I was kind of already oriented that way. But I guess what I'm saying is there's a kind of a groundswell, and it was also connected to a lot of other, you know, more mainstream groups. There's a lot of working together at the time, which I think we lost. Mm-hmm. And we lost, I'd say, mostly not because of repression, but because of recuperation or co-optation by the Democratic Party and their big foundation funders who funded a lot of these and kind of controlled the sort of the agenda and the direction of the major environmental groups, you know, who I could name by name, whatever, but I won't right now. But, you know, the whole forest protection movement kind of got sidetracked into supporting a very narrow agenda of trying to support legislation and lobbying and basically, in my opinion, lining the pockets because of their publicity campaigns, a lot of these big environmental groups, and really achieving much less than could have been done if that original, like, kind of working together kept going and not supporting Bill Clinton. I mean, so Obama is like Bill Clinton too, you know? It's like basically like the grassroots energy that went into, that had been going into more direct action orientation and kind of ended up, funneling into like the anti-globalization movement in Seattle. But a lot of it ended up getting siphoned off into political compromising and institutional electoral politics. But anyway, we do have some other callers. I know you'd like to respond to that, but let's get at least another caller on the line. Harvey, go ahead, Harvey.
Hi there. Well, hello, Paul, Justin, and Tim. Great show today.
Hello.
Very important what you're doing. And I just want you to know that the corporate media is the environmental movement's biggest enemy. They work night and day, the think tanks, against that, because it's against their interests. And recently I opened up Yahoo, my Yahoo Mail, and there was an ad on the top for a movie, and it was about environmentalists as terrorists, and it showed like an oil refinery, and they got the COE, and they're, or the CO, and they taped them up, and it just and I see there, there's corporate America putting out movies that environmentalists are the bad guys, and they made it really look that way. So I want you to know Hollywood is working against you, pretty much, and the money is working against you. But we had something happen the other day that I think was phenomenal, and I think it's time to take advantage of it. We had the March Against Monsanto.
Oh, that's
somebody,
right.
Somebody started a website, some woman somewhere, and it caught fire around the world, and then before you know it, millions were marching against Monsanto. And I think that social networks are the way to go. This is the new direction, and the corporate media cannot control that. So I think that's the key to the future, is working through social networks. And you can have, like, flash occupies everywhere, you know, about issues, about important issues. So I think that's you got to go with the new technology and leave the corporate media behind in the dust.
Absolutely.
That's the way. That's it.
All right. Well, thank you, Harvey.
Thank you.
Appreciate Bye-bye. You calling. Yeah, Monsanto, what like almost a poster child for a corporation that deserves widespread scrutiny, maybe even better than Shaq. I mean, Monsanto in terms of their reach.
Monsanto, yeah. I kind of comment on his comment about using social media, and we want to be. I mean, we're not. None of us that are organizing this are all that adept at social media, but we are trying to kind of utilize.
Yeah, if you existing, are, you should join Resistance
existing social online social networks and other forms of technology that are useful. However. To say that those are not within the grasp of corporate media or corporate interests is not correct.
That was part of the downfall of Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty,
essentially, yes. I mean, at any point, no matter who you might have that's hosting your website, or if you're just using Facebook and things like that, Facebook is notorious for will just give over information to the FBI. And a lot of hosting companies will just give over information to the FBI, and essentially they can shut you down pretty quick. Obviously, we haven't experienced this kind of form of extreme repression, but it's not like social media was not shut down during the Arab Spring. But that's kind of it's a supplement that is necessary, and we do agree that it's something that needs to be better utilized. But let's not replace face-to-face communication. That's a huge thing that once also is a driving force of social movements, is being able to travel to see one another in different cities, going to events to see one another in different cities, and not just simply liking a page or saying, yes, I'm going to go to this event, but being able to meet someone is far
affinity
more...
Affinity groups.
And it's a far more real experience knowing someone face-to-face than just having an online profile and saying, like, I support that person's work. It's, you know, we definitely need to have both.
And we do have some more callers on the line. Mariah, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
I've been listening to you fine fellows for the last hour or so, and I can really hear your passion and your dedication. I think what's missing is the effectiveness of your message. Earlier you were talking about wanting to broaden your base of supporters, to deepen that and strengthen that. And what I'm hearing is a need on your part to really clarify your message and to improve the effectiveness of your message. I recommend to both of you joining a Toastmasters club, because that, I know that's a little cheesy and old-fashioned sounding, but that will really help you improve your communication, to hone your message, and to connect you with a lot of mainstream people. And, you know, I think that, by and large, Americans care about what you're talking about and really want to contribute to your cause, but you really do need to improve the way that you're getting your message out. That's all.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks, Mariah. And that is noted and taken into consideration?
It's definitely a part of the discussion, is our messaging and communication, especially with the broader public that does not consider themselves necessarily allies, because we've isolated ourselves. And part of the way we isolate ourselves is through language. I am very guilty of not communicating those things well.
Yeah, I mean, and on that, that's like an excellent critique for, you know, for both of us. Like, you know, it is 8 in the morning for us. We're probably not communicating as best we can, but, you know, we are always looking for critiques like that as a movement and never shy of that. In fact, the end component, if your last caller, I missed the name, I apologize, but
Mariah,
at the end of the conference, we have a closing talk that's going to be facilitated to kind of really critique and, you know, highlight where shortcomings were with the movement so that we can grow and build. But Toastmasters, that's definitely a great suggestion.
Yeah, I mean, public speaking. I mean, we're in talking to Justin and Tim before, we're kind of talking about, like, the whole history of as I sort of touched on just a couple minutes ago, of Earth First and my personal experiences. And, you know, for all, you know, that he's deserves to be criticized and has been criticized, Dave Foreman, one of the founders of Earth First, just had a really amazing public speaker style. And I think there's a certain resistance in our circles towards the idea of leadership. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, like, strong, powerful oratory and, like, what you might call charisma is sort of goes along with that. But I think that's, like, I think that might be a mistake. I mean, I think really strong public speakers, you know, as long as, you know, they're not, like, that's not, you know, they do other stuff, too. And I think Foreman certainly did. And, you know, a lot of people in movements have also not just been the charismatic figurehead. They've also been done a lot of nuts and bolts work, too. But I think that's a really important thing that we maybe don't emphasize enough. But we do have only 5 minutes left, and we have two more callers. Linda, you're on the air.
Hi, Paul. This is Linda Olson Osterlund, and hi, Tim and Justin.
Hi, Linda.
Hello again.
I wanted to call in because I got a response from an email to our show. One of the many where the people said they really appreciated the show, but this one was a woman who's an activist in reproductive rights and has been all her life, and the violence that people who stand up for reproductive rights and the right to a woman to choose abortion, you know, the murder of doctors and the basically sanctioned because there's been so little to stop it. And, you know, even people here locally were put on the 10 most wanted list by the right wing and had to go out every morning with federal marshals to protect their home and their children. And so that woman was saying, it's too bad I didn't hear that they were reaching out to the people from that area. So I wanted to bring that up to you and suggest that you actively reach out to women who are working in the reproductive rights arena and struggle. There's really been what many called a war against women last year in terms of the way that the right was referring to women who used birth control, et cetera. So I wondered if you could talk to that. I knew you were up for the question, and thanks for being on the show again, and thanks for doing the conference.
Thanks, Linda.
Thank you so much.
I'll take your answer offline. Okay.
Yeah, maybe I can answer that. First of all, that is a great response, and I just want to, you know, highlight that this is the very first conference. This is a very new group, and we want to be reaching out and becoming close with everyone. For us, we, for this conference, were able to draw upon all of the allies that we had made through Occupy Portland and through people and networks that we knew. So we really tried to reach out as far as we could. Obviously, we knew that there was still more connections that we could make. And, you know, we hope that we get to hear from that person that reached out to us. Maybe we can get in contact with them, but we know we're going to continue to be having conferences and publications, and we're always looking for people to submit to the publication so that all of these voices are heard, because, you know, Justin and I are just, you know, we just come from where we come from, and we know we also have a lot to learn, and we always say we look forward to learning from you and working from you with you.
Oh, this is we're about wrapping up here. This is Talk Radio. My name is Paul Rowland. I've been speaking with Justin Kay and Tim Hitchens. And we didn't really get into that Occupy, which is something, again, in this vision and goals, which kind of goes over the history of how the idea of resistance ecology came into being, sort of the origins, sort of the recent history, that Occupy seemed to play an important role, because some of the people that you're actually working with in organizing the conference, and some people who are going to be at the conference, it seemed like you met through Occupy, that whole kind of coming back into actually working together more directly, sort of Occupy really helped that. That's another long conversation. Mm-hmm. And maybe if you have some final thoughts, we only have like another minute.
I just want to say maybe that Occupy Portland for us was kind of, you know, we had already been thinking about resistance ecology as a movement, and something that, you know, the animal rights movement needed to get out of isolation was a more broad approach to everything. And when Occupy Portland happened, it kind of catalyzed the whole idea for us. We met some really amazing, incredible people from some local grassroots groups here. And, you know, while Occupy Portland itself kind of died out, the networks that were built are so strong at this point that, you know, we are going to continue to build and move from here.
So that's about all we have time for today. Again, if you want to find out more about this Resistance Ecology Conference, it's conference.resistanceecology.org. And that's coming up this weekend at Portland State University. My name's Paul Rowland. You've been listening to Wednesday Morning Talk Radio on your community radio station, KBOO.FM.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River in the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis in Albany. The time is 9 o'clock straight up. Coming up next on Political Perspectives, host Norman Solomon, co-founder of RootsAction.org and founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, talks about his recent article, Our Twisted Politics of Grief in the Endless War. Some kinds of grief are more useful than others. At 9:30 from the series Economic Update, host Richard Wolf interviews independent journalist and writer Laura Flanders of Grit TV. At 10 o'clock, hear Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, a report on Israel's role in arming the Guatemalan military of the 1980s, and the weekly report on occupied Palestine with Nora Barrows-Friedman and the electronic intifada.net. And at 11 on the radio zine, host Bruce Silverman interviews Portland's noise control officer Paul Van Orden, his predecessor Paul Herman, and Noise Review Board Chair David Sweet as they talk about noise control in Portland.
Pride Northwest Incorporated is proud to announce its 2013 official Pride schedule of events for June 9th through 16th. We have a full week of exciting happenings designed to showcase and celebrate the LGBTQ community, including a Star Trek theme party, a special film screening, a comedy showcase, and a Tony Award-winning musical. The week will conclude with the 43rd annual Portland Pride Waterfront Festival and Parade, June 15th and 16th, at Tom McCall Park. More information about the Portland Pride Festival and Parade can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events. Blank Stares is a Portland, Oregon-based collective and electronic music label. They host a monthly all-ages sonic buffet called Beat Together. This month's Beat Together will take place the evening of May 31st at the Timeshare Gallery, Northwest Broadway in Portland, featuring Allie, B-Side, Meek Sneak, and Slow Sleeve Love. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives. I'm speaking with Norman Solomon, the founding director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and author of many books, including War Made Easy, how presidents and pundits keep spinning us to death. He has an article published on Monday in Common Dreams, and it is available on his website, which is normansolomon.com. It's called Our Twisted Politics of Grief, and subtitle, so to speak, is In the Endless War, Some Kinds of Grief Are More Useful Than Others. Norman, this is an article that is about a recent speech by President Obama. It's about U.S. foreign policy, war, and military actions, but it is written in terms of grief and how grief affects people. Why did you choose to write about grief in this context?
Well, I've been thinking about the ways that politics does and doesn't deal with grief for a really long time. And so much of our political discourse, including among progressives, doesn't directly address the kind of gaps between how Americans in our own news media and public discussion address grief of Americans and how the grief of other people is dealt with. And essentially, after working on a lot of issues of war and peace for really a few decades, I've been more and more struck by a sort of an emotional apartheid that affects our public discussion and our politics, that grief is really profound when it affects the Americans who are focused on, and that it's incidental if it's other people, particularly those who are made in a mournful situation by U.S. military action. And so that tremendous gap seems almost to be the emperor's new clothes, that it isn't really mentioned directly. It's sometimes mentioned obliquely, sometimes when there's a tragedy like the bombing at the Boston Marathon, then there'll be a commentary from someone in the progressive arena saying, well, gee, how come we care about those kids, but we don't seem as a society or mass media to be caring much about kids who are bombed by U.S.-led NATO forces in Afghanistan, for example. And I think those are important points to make. They're not often made frontally about this overall phenomenon of what I call in the article Our Twisted Politics of Grief.
And has this, do you think, always been the case? Is there some event?